Welcome to the first episode of Beneath the Surface, a podcast by the BC Mining Law Reform Network. Founded in 2019, BCMLR is a network that promotes changes to mineral development laws and mining practices. The network represents nearly 30 local, provincial, and national organizations, including citizen and community groups, First Nations, academics, as well as social justice and environmental organizations. I'm your host, Umair Muhammad. I'll be chatting with Nikki Skuse and Jamie Neen. Nikki is the director of the Northern Confluence Initiative, and Jamie is the Outreach Coordinator and Canada Program Lead at Mining Watch Canada. And together, Nikki and Jamie are co-chairs of BCMLR. In this episode, we'll explore the driving forces behind the creation of BCMLR, the critical gaps in current mining laws in BC, and the impact these laws have on both communities and the environment. We'll also discuss BCMLR's strategies and vision for the future, the role of public awareness and advocacy in shaping mining policy, as well as how listeners can get involved and support BCMLR's mission. Without further ado, let's get going. And to start with, I was wondering if you could both tell us a little bit about yourselves.
Who wants to go first?
Go for it, Jamie.
So, well, my background is actually in biology, and I started working on environmental monitoring and environmental assessment and planning with communities affected by mining activities, and sort of kept going from there because I could see what was happening as a result of mining. I was seeing the kind of anxiety and the effects of mining in the environment and on communities and in the watersheds. And the kind of policies and decision-making that went into that. So it just kind of went on from there.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm Nikki Skuse. I'm the director of the Northern Confluence Initiative, and I'm based in a small town in northern British Columbia called Smithers in Wet'suwet'en Territory. And I did a lot of international work. And then after the Mount Polley disaster happened in 2014, I realized there was not that many environmental organizations working on mining issues in the province. And so sort of created this entity and started working on both conservation issues, but also on mining reform.
Right. Actually, so that was going to be my next question. What was the driving force behind the creation of BCMLR? And I guess you mentioned Mount Polley. Is that it? Or is there something else, other incidents or realizations that prompted the creation of BCMLR?
Yeah, so the Mount Polley mine disaster was definitely, it's the largest environmental mining disaster in Canadian history. It saw over 24 million cubic meters of toxic sludge burst through and go down to Polley Lake and down through Hazeltine Creek into Quesnel Lake, which is part of the Fraser watershed. And definitely the Indigenous peoples from around there and the community people from around there were pretty upset and traumatized by it and vocal and spoke out. And definitely there was a desire to sort of get, with some leadership from Hugo Lapointe, who was with Mining Watch Canada, beforehand, there was sort of an idea to look towards like what capacity was out there and who else was working on mining issues. And so we pulled together a meeting, and then there seemed to be enough interest to form some kind of network. And so we got some funding to work with the Environmental Law Center and have them help really create the foundation that we could build on to form a network. So they did. They had all their environmental law students under the direction of Calvin Sanborn look at the various mining laws and issues and sort of poke around of what kind of gaps and best practices were missing and what were some recommendations. And so then we used that as a kind of platform from which to solidify the network. And we launched the BC Mining Law Reform Network in May of 2019.
Great. Nikki, your answers are setting up my forthcoming questions perfectly so far. So what are the gaps that you identified in the current state of mining laws in BC?
So quite a few, actually. BC likes to have this narrative that we have the strongest mining laws or environmental regulations, but that is sort of a self-declared statement, and they don't. So we discovered quite a few gaps and issues. There's definitely around, in terms of just following up on the Mount Polley, there's definitely a lot of issues around tailings design, not prioritizing safety. And also the need to kind of use potentially some other technologies and methods or dewater at the end. So there's not these massive tailings dams. And a big thing around a big gap that was identified from that was also around the lack of monitoring. There had been quite a number of cuts to the public service that had happened. And so there was very few boots on the ground and people monitoring the situations and knowing what to look for. So that's an issue that has been slightly improved since then, although I think still could use some. The tailings design piece still needs a lot more advocacy. There was a bunch of gaps around environmental assessment, around the Mineral Tenure Act, which I'm sure we'll discuss a little bit further, but that's, really a colonial law that sets out the ability to stake for $1.75 a hectare in over 76% of the province. So on private lands, on indigenous lands, and some wildlife habitat areas, community watersheds, and other places, the only things off limits are parks and under dwelling or near dwellings, as well as just a small handful of no staking reserves that have been created lately. Yeah, and then there's, we have water pollution issues. There's a lot of selenium pollution from Teck's coal mines in the southeast. There's the Tulsqua Chief Mine that's been leaching acid mine drainage for over almost 70 years into the Taku watershed, which is important salmon habitat. Those are some of the critical gaps and issues, I guess.
Yeah, and I would just say that they kind of cover the whole mining cycle. So right from exploration, from staking and exploration, right through to mine development and operation, right through to mine closure and eventual abandonment. So we've got abandoned mines across the province that are in many cases unsafe. They're leaching contaminants into the environment. There are, tailings dams that are at risk of collapse, and we need to know how dangerous they are and how to make them safer. We've got operating mines that are dumping effluent into the environment and contamination, in many cases illegally, without adequate enforcement. And at the front end, we've got all of these issues around staking and the fact that you can stake, you can place a mining stake, you can stake a claim pretty much anywhere, as Nikki said, and then that really impedes both conservation and planning, for protected areas or parks or other land uses, but also especially for First Nations, because mineral claims are being staked in their territories without their permission, and it's just it creates a legal impediment to them. It's an infringement on their rights, and it's an obstacle to their work and their development.
Maybe let's dig a little bit deeper into that. So what does staking entail? What does that allow someone to do? Like drill core samples or?
Well, when you stake a claim, when you go and basically all you have to do is register yourself as a free miner, and you get a little certificate saying that you're a free miner. And then you can go online and you can make a mining claim anywhere, pretty much anywhere in the province. What that allows you to do is go on the land, basically with hand tools. You can do some trenching, digging, sampling, and so on. You can't do full-on drilling and so on, but it does allow you to make access ways and so on. And it can be disruptive and destructive and just on its own. But mostly it's just creating an interest in the land that then opens the way for mining. And as I say, without so much as asking permission.
Okay, so what are some ways that BCMLR has been working to address the things that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think As mentioned, our foundation was sort of really based on a bunch of looking at the regulations and laws and policies and identifying some recommendations. And we decided to prioritize and come up with just like a few focus areas. So one was around Mineral Tenure Act reform. And so that work's ongoing. This past year, we were interveners. Some of us were interveners in the Kitkatla court challenge, challenging this law and its consistency with the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And the result of that, while there was some political signals to reform this law before that, the court directive is to reform the Mineral Tenure Act in the next 18 months. And so we're going to continue to advocate, be part of government relations, and ensure that community voices are heard in that process, and continue to help amplify Indigenous voices and stories from those impacted by mineral claims. Then another one of our priorities is around water pollution and tailings. And that one is, what we've done is also produced a number of reports. We were part of an international effort looking at safety first, of how to, which is sort of like the best practices of tailings design and regulation. So continue to push for that. We also produced a couple of maps that look at the risks of tailings and what actually exists in British Columbia to get a better picture of contaminating and potentially contaminating mine sites, as well as tailings dams, and what kind of design, what's held in there, who owns the mine, where it is in British Columbia. And with that too, with expert opinion, I've come forward with some recommendations. So for both of those, like the, you know, water and waste are definitely the mining industry's biggest challenges, and there's no silver bullet solution. So it can get pretty policy wonky fast, but it's definitely, you know, a key concern to everybody, I think, making sure that our watersheds are kept and our drinking water is kept clean. And lastly, we decided to focus on polluter pays. So making sure that mining companies pay for the cleanup. There are a bunch of abandoned sites around British Columbia that need to be cleaned, but this was more about ensuring that we're not left with more. And so trying to close the liability gap. And so we worked quite a bit with the province on coming up with a new policy. We didn't get everything we wanted. We were asking for full bonding up front for reclamation costs, which would mean that a mine company would the government would have the money set aside for the mining company to be able to clean it up at the end of the mine's life cycle. And we did see a lot of improvements, and we're already seeing that liability gap close in the first year that this policy has been in place. So that's hopeful, but we'll continue advocating for that. And the other part of that that we advocated for is, you know, right after you had the Exxon Valdez brutal oil spill, an international fund was created that was funded by industry to help communities who are impacted by oil spills and help with cleanup. And the same thing happened after Lac Mégantic. There was the train oil disaster explosion that happened in Quebec. And after that, there was changes that were immediately made to rail safety and also to ensuring that companies couldn't just go bankrupt and walk away, that there was some kind of fund, some kind of additional assurance. And so that's what we've been advocating for in the mining sector. We did not get that after Mount Polly, and we continue to advocate for this as something. Fortunately, Mount Polly did not go bankrupt. And, you know, there's a lot of taxpayer funding through tax loopholes and other things, as well as like just government efforts. But, you know, the community was never compensated. There's never been anybody fined or charged or anyone penalized. So, you know, what we're asking for is some kind of public interest fund that could go to help supporting communities or help cleaning up in the case that maybe the company did go bankrupt if there was a disaster. So we will continue to do that. And so part of that is through government relations, producing reports or briefs, communications, getting people to sign petitions and showing public support, getting our membership, which is throughout the province, writing letters to the editor or meeting with their MLA, or what have you.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it successful is, you know, being able to bring those things together. So, you know, we're building the kind of technical knowledge base, bringing together the knowledge and experience from communities. So, you know, downstream of the Mount Polley disaster and the concerned citizens of Quesnel, looking at the Quesnel Lake, you know, and the monitoring and so on around that. And then taking that and building public awareness around it, building public support, and then being able to use both of those, both the technical content and the political pressure to make change.
Okay, looking at the broad picture, what key changes would we like to see in the coming years?
Well, I'll start first of all with the changes to the mineral staking regime. So this is something that definitely we're looking forward to seeing changed by 2025 at the very latest because of the court challenge. And so what we'd like to see is just that there's some definite no-go zones for mining, and that there's a need to ask permission before, you're able to proceed to get the legal rights to your claim, is basically in a nutshell what we'd like to see. And so there's a lot of, I think, hopeful work and hard work to do in the next year and a bit to see those changes made. Then I'm punting it to you, Jamie, for something on tailings and water.
Sure. I mean, I think overall what we're looking to do is put mining in its place, because mining will continue, but it can't continue to set the agenda. And, you know, with the climate crisis as well as the pressure on biodiversity, freshwater, and the problems with other land uses across the province, like logging and the impact on salmon populations, for example. So, you know, we've got a lot of focus to bring forward around just the combination of these things, and you know, in the context of the climate crisis and the you know, increased extreme weather and flooding and landslides and so on, both posing a risk to mining activity and being exacerbated by the mining installations themselves. So, you know, we're looking at trying to de-risk, I think is the technical term, like make the tailings dams safer, the existing ones, and to make sure that whatever's being introduced and approved going forward is actually safer for the long run, and you know, not creating risks and liabilities for future generations that are just going to get more and more severe as time goes by.
Yeah, and I think also, like, as we will try to keep pushing for that disaster fund or public interest fund, and see if we can make a bit of progress on that. But I think also we're just looking at, there's a lot of mining pressure happening with the so-called critical minerals push, and so there's a real need to sort of push to broaden the conversation so that it's not just used to sort of greenwash and get a bunch of new mines opened, but we really need to have the conversation look to, yes, we need to get off fossil fuels. And yes, some of that will be through needing more mined materials for things like solar power, solar panels, and electric vehicles. But we don't have enough resources globally to swap out every fossil fuel vehicle for an EV one. And we need to definitely look to public transit and active transportation and recycling and reusing and just reducing our footprint overall. So British Columbia should be releasing a critical mineral strategy, and we'll just continue to try to amplify that conversation and ensure that, like a gold mine isn't using this whole notion of critical minerals to greenwash its operation, because gold is not a critical mineral for any reason.
But I need it to look nice. No, we don't need it. Okay, so you already mentioned that these discussions can very quickly become wonkish, but I'm wondering, what do you think about the place of public awareness alongside advocacy in driving change? Like, why should people really care and, you know, try to get past the wonkishness, or I guess, how should we also think about speaking in a way that's accessible and not, you know, turning people away?
Yeah. Well, one thing is that the mining industry is so ensconced in politics in BC and across Canada that it really exercises a lot of power politically. And the only way that we can counter that, like we can't mount the same kind of lobbying effort that the mining industry does. We don't have the money and resources and the lawyers and lobbyists to do that kind of thing. And we don't have that kind of personal relationship with, you know, senior people in government. But we do have the public support, and we do have people who are able to go, like Nikki mentioned, you talk to your MLA, you go to the constituency offices, you write letters, you engage with them, you make them answer questions, and you know, people are able to educate ministers and ordinary MLAs all on their own if they have the backing and the support. So, you know, part of what we can do is just mobilize that, give people the information, make sure that they have enough of a feeling for the issues to be able to make those presentations and have those conversations and build that pressure that then, you know, when the mining lobbyists come around, they're not the only voice and they're not the only source of information for decision makers. And that's, you know, that's really our biggest hope in trying to mobilize public engagement, public involvement around these issues. And, you know, just like building awareness so that people have an understanding of really both sides of the issue. You know, I mean, what the industry says is true. You know, if it wasn't grown, it must have been mined. We use these products in our daily lives quite a lot. We also waste a lot of them. And people are you know, beginning to be aware of that and beginning to be aware of the real costs of that industrial activity on the landscape, on communities, and what it means to have access to these materials. So, you know, bring that into conversations with politicians and decision makers, and we're starting to get somewhere.
I think that it is, though, a big uplift to try to get public awareness and attention and understanding. Like, there's definitely mining affected communities who, and workers too, who would like to see, you know, some changes made. And, you know, I think we just need to share stories and share some of those community voices and just try to create that understanding. Like, I remember learning about, you know, it was always like, how on earth was that mine even allowed? You know, how is it that company was even able to propose building a mine on that like key salmon habitat? Like, how did that even happen? You know, and everything just sort of always came down to the Mineral Tenure Act. And so you're like, oh, okay, the staking thing is the problem. So now we need to go to that. And then I think as soon as you sort of share the stories, you know, of that Kamloops couple who were having a glass of wine on their porch when this guy came and started like poking around and digging around in their yard, and they had no right to stop him because he was able to stake a claim online. And you sort of hear these stories and they're really egregious. Like, of course we need to modernize. And I think people get that. Like, of course you should have to ask permission before you can go ahead and proceed with some kind of mineral exploration and activity. And so I think there's just a need to share stories and get the facts out there.
And so for listeners who want to get involved or support BCMLR's mission, what are some ways they can do that?
Yeah, great. Well, we have a website and social media channels, Reform, am I going to get this right? Reform BC Mining. I have to say that.
Yeah, sign up on our website, reformbcmining.ca.
Yeah, and through our social, follow us on social media channels. We've got a great newsletter. We only sort of send something out once a month to provide updates and or opportunities for engagement or participation in government consultation processes or what have you. And you go to our website and you read some of the reports that we have and you think that, you know, we're in the right direction, just reach out and if you want to become a member of the network.
Yeah, we do have petitions and letter writing tools on the website, and you can join the network, share your experience and ideas, connect with others, get out there.
That's our show, everybody. Thanks to Nikki and Jamie for the insightful discussion, and to everyone listening. Remember that the challenges we discussed today From protecting our ecosystems to ensuring that mining companies are held accountable for the harmful impacts of their practices, these are not just issues for those who are directly affected. They are concerns for all British Columbians and, indeed, for anyone who values social and environmental justice. As we move forward, let's remember the key roles that public awareness, community involvement, and proactive policymaking will play in reshaping mining practices. For those inspired to contribute to this cause, remember that every voice counts, whether it's through supporting BCMLR, engaging in discussions within your community, or staying informed about mining practices and laws. Your involvement can and does make a difference. Your engagement and support are crucial in driving meaningful conversations and actions towards a more sustainable and just world. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so yet. By subscribing, you'll stay updated with our upcoming episodes, each exploring different facets of mining and its impacts on BC and its inhabitants. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.